Before you listen to this podcast, you can subscribe to The Critic, Britain's best in-print periodical, for just £25 for 5 issues. Subscribe now at www.thecritic.co.uk.
Welcome back to Critical Mash, a place where critics and artists get together to discuss the things that make life worth living, even as everything collapses around our ears and the royal family and the House of Lords are helping police with their inquiries. My name is Robert Thickness. I write about opera and music for The Critic. We're gathered here on a beautiful spring day, 2 days after his 341st birthday, in the middle of the London Handel Festival, in the presence of a slightly intimidating, handsome bust of the man himself. Talking today about George Frederick Handel with two people who probably know more about him and his music than anyone else in the country. Catherine Hogg, who for over 20 years has been librarian at the Gerald Cook Handel Collection at the Foundling Museum in London. Gerald Cook Collection contains 15,000 items, at least, of manuscripts and scores and letters and paintings and ephemera and concert tickets and scribbled bits of, probably shopping lists of Handel, that kind of thing, yeah? I said more wine, 12 gallons of port, yes please, which is an unrivaled picture of artistic and social life in London in the early 18th century, and Catherine knows everything about everyone who was anyone in London at the time, as we are going to find out. And Harry Beckett, the extremely eminent conductor and harpsichordist, who for 20 years has been artistic director of the English Concert, and also has a huge international career as a conductor, including music director of Santa Fe Opera, and really one of the most eminent Handelians of our time, currently involved in a somewhat insane project called Handel for All, which involves video recording every note that Handel wrote for free streaming to air for everyone to enjoy. How's it going, Harry?
Well, we're, you know, chipping away at the rock face, we'll see.
Not many, 60 dramatic works and then a few bits and pieces, yes?
Yeah? So absolutely.
A few concerti grossi in that.
Yeah, and also stuff that he wrote as a young man in Italy, which he probably would be horrified that we're resurrecting and never expected to be still performed 350 years later. But that is the nature of that what we do now, and you know, no composer can think that a piece that he wrote on a bad day won't somehow see the light somewhere on the internet. No, absolutely. And also, if you have to remember, in the 18th century, everything was about your new piece. I mean, the idea that we'd be still performing these works hundreds of years later. I mean, I'm sure if he came back, he'd say, "Well, why are you doing my music?
Where's yours?
Yeah. Absolutely."
And then you play him some of ours and he could go, "Oh, I see. I understand everything. Carry on." Okay, that's and of course, my old pal Yehuda Shapiro. Yehuda, the Statler to my Waldorf around the opera bars of the country for the last 25 years. And a man who I thought would be probably more at home with kind of, you know, Szymanowski and Richard Strauss than Handel. Yehuda, is that your traditional stamping ground?
I'm very proud to say the first ever professional opera I saw was Ottone when I was 11 years old at Chichester Festival Theatre. And I asked Mummy and Daddy if I could go and see it. And I don't know how I got through 3 hours of da capo arias with no surtitles at the age of 11, but I did. And I wouldn't say it set me on the path to handlery, but I think it was quite a debut. But it's been interesting to see how Handel has evolved over
had fantastic singers, right?
Had Anna Reynolds and Josephine Bastow, even though I didn't know who Anna Reynolds and Josephine Bastow were at the time.
And no countertenors.
I don't know. Is there a countertenor in Ottone?
It's mainly women, yeah. So it's, yeah.
But it's hardly ever been put on since. I think it's had a couple of productions over the last...
Well, it's got some of the most glorious music he ever wrote, but it is, the libretto is, it's hard to make a case for it.
I mean, it's been done. I saw Christian Kernan did it with the early opera gang a few years ago. Yeah.
Oh, right.
4 years ago or something,
with,
I think.
No, I mean, I remember much longer. With Nisha did one of her kind of typical rather misanthropic productions. But, of course you could say about nearly every Handel opera, it contains some of the most glorious music he ever wrote. I mean, this is the thing, isn't it? Even when he was kind of churning them out. Anyway, so Handel, as we know, is almost overbearingly well known and yet still rather an enigma in many ways. He was at the centre of London life and its most active artistic circles at one of the most, exciting and boisterous and gossipy periods. Not that anybody had anything to say about him. And as well as that, the Handel that we grew up with was kind of known for grand ceremonial coronation, fireworks, hallelujah choruses and so forth, and this kind of pomposo ceremonial and patriotic stuff. And our perception of him has changed enormously in the last 30 years, as he's now reverted to we now realise that he is the operatic composer that he was, which is completely different. It's all intimate and personal and about very intimate feelings and things like that. Anyway, so that's what we're going to deal with. So because we're used to kind of huge middle-aged Handel striding around, I thought we'd better start with him much earlier. Age of 25, he pops up in London from kind of nowhere. I mean, he's been in Italy. And within about 5 seconds, he's at the centre of royal life and court life, and the artistic life. He's moved in with Lord Burlington. How does it work? How did he inveigle himself so quickly into all this?
Well, London was the place to be. I mean, it was definitely the melting pot of Europe, artistically, at the time. And, of course, he spoke German, which I think was a very big in for him, because, of course, George I didn't speak English. So immediately you can connect, get yourself in court circles and connect with the king. You know, he'd been, unlike Bach, he'd done his travels, he'd been to Italy. He was sort of quite a man of the world in the sense that he knew, I think, how courts worked. You know, he'd worked for courts in Italy. And so coming to London, he sort of understood the structure of probably how to get into court life more easily. And I think the language was probably a great help. And, of course, he was quite confident. He was someone who was happy to sell himself, I think, and come up front and get in the way of the other musicians. So I know he wasn't ever master of the king's music, but that didn't stop him getting all the plum jobs, the coronation music, etc.
Much to other people's chagrin, as it turned out.
Well, it appears to be. Yes, well, it would, wouldn't it? If you've just got to do all the duff stuff and someone else gets to do the all the big events. So I think that must be how he got in the first place, having the language to connect and to have the connections, with the Queen's.
Kind of makes sense. I guess George didn't have many people he could talk German to, apart from his wife and mistresses.
Yeah, I mean, it was a closed world, and they were very, very removed. Well, she'd been dispatched back to Germany, because but he didn't. They were very removed, and I think things like, well, the water music, for example, that was supposed to be with the king to show himself to his people. So the people did connect, and they weren't just stuck in their palaces. That was a sort of performative populism.
I mean, you do get the impression that he was very boisterous, very kind of bumptious almost. I mean, very charming. This is how he got around Italy. He charmed all those cardinals in 5 seconds in Rome and got all those amazing commissions. And this kind of charm and bumptiousness seems to sort of wear off as time goes by. As he becomes kind of more and more unpopular, because he monopolises the whole of the London music scene.
I think, because he becomes so established and he is so far above everybody else in that sense, he doesn't need to push himself. But on the other hand, I think he was quite... The entrepreneur comes through all the time, because he comes over to London and from nowhere he starts doing Italian operas, and gets in on the act quite early on. I mean, 1711, I think, is his first opera in London, and doesn't get daunted by the mixed receptions and all those lovely conspiracy theories that you can read about.
But he come from the success of Agrippina, which was just such a massive event. I mean, he must have been really pretty buoyed by that, and on the back of that comes to London, and also has the inn with all these amazing singers that he knew he could bring in, who were these sort of exotic larger than life characters as well. So it was a real kind of showtime, wasn't it? In a way, when you look at what the English were doing in terms of their musical theatre. I mean, it was like
a different world.
A totally different world.
There was a kind of different style. I mean, the Purcell style, or the style of the kind of Charles court, was entirely French, right? And derived from Lully and Rameau and all those kind of, well, Lully. But, you know, Purcell being a person who kind of synthesized lots of things, but used the French style a lot. And his successors, like John Eccles, who wrote a Semele, which was never performed, I understand. I mean, but and that was swept away by the Italian style, of which Handel was the great proponent. But it just kind of seemed to have happened overnight. No more of this French stuff. I don't know whether it was because it was associated with the previous court and the Stuarts. And therefore the Georges just and all their kind of hangers-on thought, right, let's have a different thing.
I don't know the answer to that. I mean, I think it was just like a big truck of these people turned up,
right,
and just said, this is what we do.
Okay, mm-hmm.
And it caught on fire, and not just the music and the singing, but you know, these people were, you know, the stories about these singers. You know, it was a bit like getting sort of Hello magazine, you know,
yeah.
You'd hear all the gossip about who was sleeping with who and who'd threatened to punch who and the fights, you know, the sopranos fighting and the castrati fighting. And it was like, it was very Trumpian, if I dare say, that you just sort of basically...
It was celebrity, wasn't it? It sort of brought in celebrity.
The idea that, you know, yeah. You're watching a reality show and you need a new story every day. And then so that when you went to the opera, when the person walked on stage, it wasn't just the person, it was the whole... Yeah.
The backstory.
Yes. Backstory. And there they were on stage.
And was society very sort of in ferment at the time in the country? I mean, was it particularly... Do you think it was a particularly receptive period to change and to novelty, or...?
Well, I suppose you still had the sort of the Stuart tail end, you know, going on really with the Jacobites and so on, but... But I think people, it was such an international city really at the time. I think it was more so than any in Europe, and of course it was growing so fast. The population was just exploding, you know, in the mid half of the 18th century, I suppose. So,
but also a massive middle class, and that was interesting because the beginnings of popular theatre in the true sense, you know, theatre for the people that. Yes, it was on one level an elevated art form, but it was written for middle-class people to be able to go and see as well. I mean, that's why when you're talking about these pieces with these, you know, sort of labyrinthine plots and mythological stories and what have you, are actually about what it feels like when someone dumps you, you know? I mean, that is something that is just, you know, that transcends all class and all education. And because the music that he writes is just so heartbreakingly direct and tuneful, mm-hmm. and not fancy or intellectual. It's very hard to do that, but what he achieves is a very simple style but that hits the nail every single time. And that's what's hugely appealing.
That's it. I mean, I'm not sure that the opera was particularly open to the middle classes. Catherine?
The upper middle classes, so lawyers and so on. Were
yeah,
they, but,
yeah.
But,
so I just meant yes. Not necessarily aristocracy and all nobles.
Because the theatre itself was rather boisterous and you know, I mean, had all those footmen in it and throwing stuff at the stage, but opera, not so much?
It did happen because, you know, basically when your maid was sent along to reserve your seat for a couple of hours before the show, and then she went up to the gallery to wait for afterwards. And,
even
yeah.
at the opera?
Even
they
at
got
the opera.
Okay, because there was this right for free... And the footmen that revolted one day when the theatres tried to charge them for
yes.
the seats, right?
Yes, because they yeah. traditionally got in for yeah. free, but, you know, up in the gods.
So they went to sit through the kind of 1970s-style opera Syria. like Yehuda.
There were lots of plumes. That's all I can remember.
I don't know how is there any record of what the footman thought about these immensely long operas?
No, you don't hear about that.
Harry, our lifetimes have coincided with this kind of the revival of Handel operas. Is that kind of still a work in progress, do you think? I mean, I haven't seen all, by any means, because there are like 40.
No, I'd be surprised anyone has actually seen.
But I've, them. But I've probably got like 20 or something under my belt. But do you think it's? I mean, they're not just like in numbers, and everyone. I see that they're doing De Damia now. They did it at Wexford, and it's going somewhere else as well in the summer. But that's not on the list. Is it? Do you think as a not just as in numbers, but in the kind of you know in terms of performance style and, you know, finding out how they should be done. Is it still a work in progress?
I mean, I think the one of the reasons why they became popular, or at least being put on, was because there were directors who found a way to make what is actually quite a rigid structure of opera seria. I mean, solo da capo aria, followed by recit, followed by another, you know, and then maybe a duet somewhere in the middle or at the end. But I mean, that is it, which is one of the reasons why people generally say, well, this is untheatrical in terms of the way in which we want, or modern audiences wish to consume entertainment. It's not, you know, people, and people also, oh, you're just so boring, I say the same thing over and over and over again. And then you get directors who come along and say, well, what if it's actually like real human emotion in real time? I mean, we're so used to operatic convention being time being telescoped. You know, I mean, Mimi knocks on the door of the garret and 6 minutes later, they're singing a love duet. It's ridiculous. But we all go, oh God, it's so real. It's so, oh. And then, you know, and with Handel, you have somebody who for 5 minutes says, I really, really love this person. And then for 3 minutes says, that person just betrayed me. And then for 5 minutes says, I really, really love that person.
Right.
And of course they say the same words in the same music, but it's in the context of their betrayal. So when they repeat it, it's very, very real in the way in which we as human beings think. And to find, you know, a way, and I have to say singers who can actually make that journey and make it real for us. And I mean, that's another thing, is we've had some fantastic artists who can really bring that to life. Then suddenly it becomes something different, I think. And that it does, as you say, you know, it's almost like a meditation on the way we are as human beings.
This is it. He talks absolutely about, you know, I mean, distress and pain, but also, you know, love and hope and joy. But I mean, these very focused, like magnifying glass things that he. And then 15 minutes of aria kind of burrows down. It doesn't go linear, time linear forwards. It goes downwards inside in this kind of
completely.
Way.
And you're. It's like someone burying their soul in front of you in a very raw, open way. So the sort of operatic convention sometimes of it being deliberately behind a wall and we're kind of watching it as observers, for me in Handel, and I didn't come from this world at all. I mean, the thing that made me jump out of my seat was seeing the Nick Heitner Xerxes at the Colosseum, which I was asked to go along to, and I was beside myself. And I just bought a ticket to every performance. And I just went again and again. I couldn't. I mean, it was such a brilliant combination of so many different things.
Very good piece, too, of course.
Great piece, but great production, you know, Anne Murray. It was just Charlie McCarris, you know, it just. But I was just fascinated how this could feel so modern and how this piece was not an old piece.
But do you think we're listening to it in a different way then? Because in the 18th century, I can't imagine an 18th century audience articulating the way you've just described.
Well, this is it.
It's much more chit-chat. Oh, somebody good's going to sing an aria.
Oh, completely, and for show. And that's what I'm saying, how the directors have found, well, what do we do with this crazy virtuosic aria about a ship coming into harbour after a storm? I mean, you know, of course it has no place really in the narrative of the story, but it's a show-stopping number. And, you know, maybe you bring on the dancing girls, as, you know, David McVicar probably did. And, you know, and on it goes. But it
I think they were sailors.
It does lift, you know, it's the spirit of it. But I completely agree. I mean, but then Handel was, you know, he was, what was the, well, everyone knows this quote of him about Messiah when someone said, I hope you know, it's been well received, and I hope you felt, you know, you entertained people. He said, I'd be sorry if I only entertained them. I wanted to make them better. which I always thought was a real decor for me of Handel, that you could be both an entertainer and a showman, because you've got to get people into the theatre by doing that, but once they're in there, you just go boom.
Totally agree with you about singers and directors that we've, I mean, at the beginning of your kind of Handel opera career, there were the Aldens and, right, Nigel Lowry, people like this. I mean, at the time, I mean, Handel would never have envisaged them. I mean, what worries me is that Handel, right, spending all this effort writing an unbelievable drama, as we now see, that he knew would never be shown on stage in his time. What was in his head was, you know, something along the lines of the drama that we see now. And yet he just had a bunch of people kind of walking rather woodenly onto stage and standing there as though they're hailing a taxi and then buggering off again.
But it probably still worked. I mean, this is the general thing with opera. Actually, I was going to say, the thing is, today we take the level of singing for granted. I mean, there are an awful lot of singers who are very good at Handel now, aren't there? Yeah. You know, they can get, you assume they're going to be able to get around the notes. You don't think, oh, we're going to have someone fudging their coloratura here. And then I think that's quite a, so maybe that's got something to do with the way it's made this transition from being a more technical thing to a more emotional, dramatic, I don't know.
Who knows? I mean, you know, you speak to the contemporaneous reports about singers and the people that he used, and it's clear, I know from, I mean, Handel wrote so specifically for specific singers. Mm-hmm. So often, you know, if there was a revival of a show and the cast changed, he, even if it was the same voice type, he would write different type of coloratura, mm-hmm, for one castrato compared to another, because he said, well, that's not going to work in his voice, but that'll work in their voice. Mm-hmm. And so, I mean, they were really tailor-made for these singers.
Catherine, this London that Handel arrives in, this is when, I mean, London is really taking off. English culture is kind of becoming itself. And there's just a huge number of writers and artists and musicians all hanging around at the same time, often in the same place, such as Dr. Johnson, Jonathan Swift, Daniel Defoe, Lady Mary Wortley Montagu, Alexander Pope, Hogarth, Kitty Clive, Peg Woffington, Garrick, Fielding, Richardson, William Kent, and so on. And a lot of them living in Burlington House or hanging around Burlington House with Richard Boyle, who was the Duke of Burlington, I guess, and other places, as they were in those days. And Handel immediately managed to inveigle himself, move in there. I mean, you know, he's somehow feels separate from that gang, but it's absolutely the centre of the artistic life.
Yeah, I don't know how he got into that circle. I don't know if he had an introduction. I assume he had an introduction somehow, but to start with. But I think he always liked to be slightly detached. That's the impression I get. You know, he wanted to know all these people and work with them or not, depending, you know, who they were. But he's very much a loner, I think, in that he never sort of signed up for any groups or organisations, you know, any of these clubs, you know, that whether it was the Masons or the court circles and so on. Never wanted a salary from anybody. He got pensions, but he didn't get a salary, so he wanted to plough his own furrow. So I think he wanted to learn from all these people that you're talking about or absorb their culture, but he didn't want to become part of it. He very much had his own way of doing things. Mm. That's what I would say musically.
And we don't even actually know whether he was living there, but he probably was.
He probably lived there for a while. I mean, he lived in Barnes at some point, don't we? We don't know really the little mystery period of his life.
And then probably went off, was poached by... Was he poached by Bridges? Chandos chap?
Well, probably, yes. Yeah. I mean, probably just got a better offer, yes, I should think. But I think with Burlington, he wasn't part of his household. I think he just lived there, you know, and then was probably looking around for a better opportunity, and then went off to...
Well, yes, so Bridges was obviously, he'd done very well out of... What, he'd been... What was it? He was controller of some big money thing, wasn't he?
Yes. Oh, goodness, what is it? It wasn't the customs, but it was one of those trade type things. Yeah, it was something to do with trade, wasn't it?
And it's and he'd managed to invest the money it was rather like Father Ted, when the money was resting in his account. Yes. And he would make it work very hard and then return it to the thing. And he made built cannons and so forth. Anyway, so Handel went up there and then hung around with them, and presumably John Gay and Alexander Pope might have been there as well, because then they wrote Acis and Galatea together,
yeah,
which was kind of a big thing, wasn't it? I mean, this is like, here we go, let's have another go at creating English opera, which has kind of started and stopped for 100 years, and here's another go. Or do you think they thought that at the time, or just thought, let's have a lovely party for aesthetes in North London with an Ovid myth set in Sicily, you know, nymphs and shepherds, is going to be great. Do you think that?
I don't know. I suspect, I mean, looking forward to the oratorios, that there was a feeling of wanting to write something in the language of the people he was performing for.
Well,
strange idea. and of course, that's, as you say, before Handel, that was what the opera was. I mean, it was in English. It was as simple as that. And I think there was an appeal to be more populist and to write pieces that could be performed in, you know, in houses. I mean, in people, not necessarily in the theatre. You could get a group of amateurs and do Acis very happily, and also coinciding with the music publishing industry, which suddenly made all this stuff available, which also was a big source of income for Handel. I mean, you know, John Walsh and that whole world of writing things, endlessly ranging things. I mean, how many arias from the operas, you know, republished for solo flute? You know, which is, of course, ridiculous, because you could just take the part and play it on the flute. But no, it was going to be published like that, and you'd go out and buy it because it had been arranged for flute. You know,
it's commerce, isn't it?
Yeah.
Yes. Nobody thought of that, did they? But I suppose they didn't have the vocal score either, so they'd have to go. Yeah.
Yeah, you couldn't actually get the music any other way, really, could you? I suppose, you know, you couldn't. I mean, it would only be manuscript copies. You wouldn't have. They'd only publish what people were going to play or sing with it. So.
There are some quite nice kind of vignettes of him in the days. So the organist at St Paul's was called Maurice Greene, and he was quite a promising musician, and yeah. I mean, quite good. I've got some old English keyboard things, and his lovely little, you know, Allegros and stuff. But, you know, not just pre-galanterie type stuff, but, you know, quite solid.
Well, there's some anthems of his which are really quite interesting.
Him and Boyce was another one who were... and I think, and there's a suggestion that they were quite pally for a bit, him and Maurice Greene, and Handel would go down and mess around with Greene on the organ, and then they'd go to the pub with the choir and sing a few things and probably get thrown out of the pub. And so, I mean, but that seems to have come to an end under certain circumstances. Is that right?
Well, I think so. Well, both Greene and Boyce were at different times masters of the King's music. Mm. So, you know, that was the official title. So obviously they were quite influential. But they didn't get the good jobs. You know, then Handel came along and, you know, oh, I'll write the coronation music and I'll write the Ode for the Birthday of Queen Anne, whatever it is, you know, these different things. So that he got into the court. I mean, the Queen Anne thing, that's more interesting because that was so early on, you know. I suspect that Greene and Boyce got a bit put out because they were just, although they had what could have been seen as the plum job socially, they didn't get the commissions, and they were completely overshadowed really by Handel, and certainly in the latter.
Do you think he wanted, I mean, it's like he wanted a monopoly and he wanted to squash everybody else and didn't care what they thought really?
I think he was just better, wasn't he? I mean, you know, I have to say, I think Greene and Boyce might have, you know, been upset by his taking all their work, but they probably heard that music and went, damn him. I mean, you know, I couldn't write as well
as
that.
Yeah, I mean, I don't think they criticised it ever, but it's, and you know, and Boyce used, Handel used to take their, well, not their tunes, but he used to take other people's tunes. And
he was big on that, yes.
Yeah.
They all did that.
Was he innovative as a composer at that point?
Well, there's a really interesting theory that actually he was not a very good composer from scratch, but he was brilliant at taking nuggets of other composers' work and shining them up into something extraordinary. I mean, there's a lot of stuff of Kaiser that, because Kaiser, he played in the orchestra, Handel played in the orchestra in Hamburg when Kaiser was music director, and if you, a lot of Kaiser, Handel just takes you know, I mean, note for note, in even the same key, but just makes it like $1 million. Yeah. And I mean, I remember doing Theodora a couple of years ago and on tour with the English concert. And I mean, some of that music is just so extraordinary and just like out of, you know, just from another planet. And we have a wonderful second violinist, Finnish guy, Tromo, who always has the manuscripts on his phone. And you know, he's one of these people that's just, you know, if you want wrong, Tromo gets his phone out and says, no, actually, I think, that, well, it could be a sharp, but I'm not quite sure about that. And I made some comment about one of the choruses, which is, you know, for me, one of the most, my favorite things. And Tromo said, yeah, well, of course, it's not by Handel. I went, what? He said, no, it's by, and I can't remember who it was by. It was not even my composer I knew.
Which chorus was that?
How great the thing, oh my God, how glorious. It's in the, it's oh, in yes, the third.
Yes. It's towards the end,
it's
right?
It's that falling mm-hmm. seventh, and I mean, it's so extraordinary, but no, it's totally lifted.
Not just the germ of it, the like, really, pretty much the whole thing.
Cantata by, I can't
remember. Damn. But he, I mean, for somebody who became an incredible tunesmith, I mean, he could write melodies like nobody else, and like Schubert, he could churn them out like Schubert. And there's a suggestion that kind of like Schubert kind of learned that as well and didn't start. Some of Schubert's early stuff doesn't have that effortless thing. And it's just kind of the same with Handel, I find. And so like Elmira, which is kind of fun, but it doesn't take off in the way that some of his later things. Maybe he didn't have anything to nick. And
no, but we know he did. But we know he did refine. I mean, you I'm sure is it the manuscript for Dovesey? Or it's one of those arias where you can see him, like just taking a bar out here and adjusting in this simple E major aria. But you know, he took such trouble to, you know, it wasn't enough just that it was a pretty tune. You know, it had to actually work. It had to work dramatically, it had to work musically, and yeah, I mean, writing a simple tune is really, really hard.
Yeah. Yes,
as it turns out. I mean, you say that he was better, which we now know, but at the time, his rivals, Ariosto and Bononcini in particular, were way more popular. I mean, so Handel's opera company, he started the Royal Academy of Music with enormous subscriptions from lots of rich people, yes, Burlington and the Duke of Earl of Newcastle and so on. They all gave like 1,000, not 1,000 a year, but 1,000 to the whole thing for over the number of years that it was going to last. And you know, there were very like the I don't know whether was Radamisto the first of the Academy operas. But there was a kind of a big opening when the King and the Prince of Wales both turned up, which was quite unusual because they hated each other. And so there was this kind of political aspect to it. And so the Academy kind of started off with a big bang, and Radamisto's, well, it's kind of a little bit, slightly gloomy opera, isn't Radamisto? Yes. But it has
a bit of murder, suicide, and
yeah. But it's there's something a bit kind of downbeat about it. It's very good, but there's something, you know, it's not all shiny and lots of trumpets or anything like that. But then as they went on, it was, I think the Academy never made any money and everybody probably lost their money. But meantime, and later on particularly, when the rival company started up, Opera of the Nobility, it was much more successful than Handel's. And whereas Handel was having kind of, you know, 9-10 performances of things, the other, they were racking up 20 and so forth.
Well, how do you think Mozart felt with Martini Soler in Vienna? I mean, you know, writing these incredibly popular pieces that everybody was not only singing but dressing like the characters in the street, and then he tries to copy him and writes Così, and that's a flop, and you know, and on it goes. I mean,
so it's just it's fickleness of taste.
Well, I would argue that, yeah, but I mean, look at the success. Okay, I'm going to get into trouble.
I mean, Soler is not too
bad. Look at the success of Andrew Lloyd Webber compared to Stephen Sondheim.
But Sondheim hasn't done badly, has he?
No.
It's a different scale, isn't it, though?
It's a different scale. I mean, you know, and I'm not saying one was trying to be like the other at all. I mean, but the fact is that Andrew Lloyd Webber has a knack of writing stuff that lots and lots of people want to hear.
Also has a knack of doing the Handel thing, of borrowing tunes. I mean, Sondheim is kind of more intellectual and appeals to it. You know, it's not shiny musicals. It's all very intense and far.
But that's true of Mozart. I mean, when he writes Magic Flute, I mean, you know, teams up with a you know, pantomime guy, and writes his stuff, and he just can't help writing serious music.
But it's interesting. I mean, I don't want to get off subject, but like Cosy. People still don't get Cosy.
No.
Because the ironies that it's all ironies, Cosy, and people say it's misogynistic, and you think, no, it isn't. And it's interesting how two and a half centuries on, people still don't realise that it's not what it appears to be on the surface. I don't think it takes any great perception to realise that.
Well, also, I mean, I don't want to go too much on a tangent, but
that's what we're all about.
the fact that he writes some of his most profound, heart-wrenching music in that piece, which is supposedly a comedy.
Yes.
And then you see that actually, of course, in his own life, he basically married the wrong sister.
Yeah.
It becomes like...
There's a concept in there.
But to me, it's the only way I can explain why he writes that music of such emotional power in a story which is really quite shallow, I might say, is because, you know, it's like his own therapy of basically marrying the wrong girl.
Quite a long time before that, wasn't it? I mean, hadn't he got used to Constanza by then?
Or not. Oh, no. This is another...
Yes, another part. Anyway, segue, not a problem that Handel had, because as we know, Handel never appears to have had any sort of intimate relationship with anybody, as far as we know, although somebody suggested that he quite liked singers. Briefly, he had brief affairs with singers, someone suggested at some point, I think.
Yeah,
is that right,
there's
Catherine?
There's a publication soon after his death which talks about two different... unnamed women, one of whom spurned him, and the other whom was not allowed because he was just a fiddler, and her daughter wasn't going to marry a fiddler.
Was that in Germany?
No, that was in England.
Oh, really?
Yes.
He was still considered just a fiddler in the kind of in the broadest possible sense.
If you're nobility,
yes.
You're not going to marry.
No. He's a servant. I mean, the music musicians are servants.
Yeah,
exactly.
Yeah.
Mm. But you know, we shouldn't be surprised that he had an amazing imagination, and he had great imaginative sympathy, right? Which is how he could write about everything. I mean, not just love, but, you know, youth and age, and I mean everything in between. Like how he, you know, dreamed up those little puppyish characters in Ariadante. Ariadante and Ginevra, who are just like, oh, look, lovely lambs and sky and everything like that. And then this Monty Python foot comes and crushes them and all those terrible things.
But that's a big theme, the sort of anti-hero. Mm. So all these, you know, Rinaldo and Orlando, Ariadante, all these people who are, well, not all warriors, but, you know, the idea that, you know, you'll be your big, big fighter, but you're undone by love. Mm. And that basically... We're not, and rulers, I mean, poor old, well, not poor old, but Grimoaldo at the end of, you know, Rodelinda just starts singing, if only I could be a shepherd, life would be so much easier. And I did a film years ago for Channel 4 called My Night with Handel, where we took like 8 arias and then we filmed it all around. It was all in a night in London. It was actually totally brilliant. I think it's still available on DVD somewhere. Anyway, John Mark Ainsley did Pastorello, this song about the ruler wanting to be a shepherd. And he was made up as Prince Charles, wandering through St. James's Park at night, you know, just sort of fretting, you know.
They weren't changing the guard.
They weren't changing the guard, indeed.
I've always thought there's that thing about Rodelinda in general, that they all want to be shepherds. And it's like, oh, it's too much for all of them. And they're just like, leave me alone. And everything's in kind of free time, these little Bessers and, you know, Sicilianos. And everyone's like, I don't want any of this. Leave me alone, I want peace. But again, Grimoaldo leaves it a little late, I guess, in the day. And does the baddie in Radamisto does something kind of similar at the end? He says,
it's having
a laugh or something.
And Armida in Ronaldo just at the end goes, okay, I'll convert. It all happens like in one bar. It's like, okay, well, I'm glad we got that sorted out.
After all that, after 3 hours of trouble. Yeah. So another thing interests me, Catherine. In 1738, the guy who basically redeveloped Vauxhall Gardens and turned them into a really massive money-spending public attraction, it's called Jonathan Tyers, decided to put a statue of Handel there. Although Handel wasn't very popular or anything at the time, why did he go for Handel, do you think?
Well, I think Handel was a known name, and I suppose maybe Handel was keen to have it done because it would be good for her, for his...
Good publicity,
publicity for him. And Roubilliac had already worked with Handel, so they were used to each other. But, I mean, he was the main man, musically, even in 1738, I think, you know, in London. And it wasn't unpopular. He just had rivals, I think. But his music was everywhere.
Yeah. Was it actually everywhere?
In the 1730s, late 1730s.
Okay, so it wasn't just like in opera houses.
No, I mean, as you say, all these arrangements for flute and everything else, you know, they were all churning out, and people were singing the songs from the shows, really. They were already being published, so it's...
And did the ceremonial music, did that kind of get out there as well? I mean, there must have been some weddings and coronations and things. Did Zadok and so forth?
The coronation anthems, they were performed, and the Chandos anthems, of course, they were all in the repertoire then. Not widely performed, I suppose, but, you know, in the abbeys and so on. But
being performed tonight by the English concert.
They are, indeed. Yeah. Yes.
But it was people wanted new music, so you didn't keep churning out the same stuff over and over again. You had to have something new still at that stage. Yes, you could repeat them, but you wouldn't, you know, the Ode for Queen Anne or something like that wouldn't get a lot of performances, I guess. I'm not aware.
No, and I don't know what the physical, I mean, what they were singing off. You know what material they had and how much that was.
There'd only be so many sets of manuscripts.
Completely,
these things were not published, so you just have to borrow a set from somewhere else, and you sort of see these letters going to and fro. Can I borrow your set of parts? You know, going down to Salisbury, for example, for a festival down there, and they would be shipping the manuscripts down, and then Handel would be saying, "Can I have them back? Because I need them for something else." Yeah. You know, and it was the post must have been more reliable in those days.
Do you think he was more political or involved in politics than we tend to think? I mean, obviously, because there was this, you know, there was the undercurrent of Jacobinism, which is still going on until 1745 anyway. And he worked with people, with non-jurors, so people who hadn't taken the oath of loyalty, I guess, to King George and so, but Charles Jennens and people like that he worked with. And yet he was... who were so technically anti-Hanoverian, but he was obviously very pro-Hanoverian because he'd got the job through them. And the one time we know that he voted Whig, which is the correct party to vote, right, if you're a Hanoverian. And yet there's this kind of, you know, he seems to have sort of straddled the divide in some way. I mean, it's like the Burlington gang were sort of anti-Hanoverians. And so how did he manage this, do you think?
He was very clever. I mean, it's like William Byrd back in the day. You know, right. he worked for everybody. So, yes, he was working with non-jurors, but then he was also writing some popular songs about our brave lads, you know, fighting the Jacobites and so on. So, it's, you know, he's very much... He kept in with everybody. How he did it, I don't know, but he kept in with the King and the Prince of Wales at the same time, even when they weren't speaking to each other.
And it's almost like that, like he was sort of used as a tool of this national. I mean, I have this theory that there's a kind of national reconciliation slowly going on. You know, the wounds of the last 100 years since 1640, since the Civil War, basically don't heal until 1745. And Handel seems to be quite central to that. I mean, what really happens is that the Jacobites burn out and it all ends at Culloden, and Cumberland kind of makes sure that it's not going to happen again in a hurry. But Handel, you know, particularly in the oratorios, he's kind of involved in constructing this idea of Englishness and this beleaguered England, which is usually Jews surrounded by... surrounded by enemies, but there's always the isolated country fighting against the heathens around it, and that is Protestant England being you know, fighting against fascist France and all these kind of things, right? And I wonder whether there was a kind of political program in there. I mean, Ruth Smith goes on about it in her book about the oratorios.
Well, I think him being an outsider was probably a big advantage because he wasn't English, so he didn't have a faction to belong to. He didn't come from a faction at all. And yes, and that's that interesting mix of obviously the Hanoverian connections. But in a way, I think because he was an outsider, he could innocently, as you might say, mix with everybody rather than, you know, nailing his flag to any particular mast. And that's, and I think as a businessman, he was very astute, and he knew that, you know, if it was good to get on with everybody and straddle both sides, and obviously building up this sense of the national sort of hero, bring up the British music, and basically they sort of called him the father of the oratorio and all that sort of thing. But it's very much the British British identity. You don't get that, you know, Germany everywhere has an opera house, in England everywhere has a choral society and that sort of thing. You know, that's it's a different world. But and he did found that and. Really, because that was because of the oratorio, but which we're going to talk about.
And I was reading Jane Glover's book, and she has this very nice image of. In the continuo arias, you know, in the early ones, and Handel and Nicola Haym, playing the cello, probably, who had written the words, and the singer, whoever it may be, you know, whether it's Margherita Durostanti or, you know, or Semizina or whatever. And there's like, so the three creators of this music, they're standing there and making it happen for the first time. Do you kind of feel that when you're with Joe and Lucy Crowe?
Well, yeah, and what's interesting is that It seems to me, that I'm not the first person to have said this, but that when the deeper and deeper and deeper Handel goes, you see him just reducing the number of players until you get to the continuo aria, which is like the most private and the most personal music, not just because it's fewer people, but because you obviously have the fewer people you have involved, the more flexibility you have. I mean, you're not asking a whole violin section to play together and to follow every whim of a singer. You know, you're basically there, and also, yes, the singer has a line and the bass line, the bass has a line, but everyone else is just improvising and can colour and can shape, no matter what they hear a singer do. And it seems to me that the heart of a lot of those pieces are in a continuo aria. And it's interesting when I first started doing Handel operas, and directors were just sort of beginning to explore how to best to put them on stage. I had a friend I did quite a lot of Handel opera with, and we always had this game of, you know, a piece. We just the score would be there. We hadn't even opened it. So we're going to go through it, and we're going to write down on a piece of paper what we think the best aria is, you know, and then when we've got to stage it, we're going to see whether we were right or not. We were almost never right, because when it actually, you know, these pieces reveal themselves, and sometimes the sort of most unprepossessing looking aria on paper actually is
the banger.
Is the banger.
Well, and he had this. I mean, the thing is, I mean, when Carestini or whoever refused to sing Verdi Prati. And it's like, you know, this is rubbish. It's three notes. Come on. Yeah. Come on, guys. Is that the best you can do? Go nick a tune from someone and brush it up. And Handel says, no, this is quite good. You sing, please. And he had spent some... He was East German. So he had a lot of contact. I'm getting my villainous accents mixed up. Did he have pets, Catherine?
No. Nope.
That's a pity. Right, and I'd like to get on to, as Yehuda suggested, we must talk about these oratorios, because it's as if they kind of happened by accident, and he really wanted to carry on writing operas, but the opera thing had just died, and the competition of two opera companies had completely killed off any chance of it happening at all. They'd ripped each other to pieces, and nobody wanted to go, and everyone was bored of the dramas associated with them, I guess. And then these nice, kind of retired Church of England vicars out in the country started sending him scripts and saying, wouldn't it be awfully nice if you wrote this kind of thing? And I don't know whether he was grudging or not, but then he started writing them. And then I feel that we sort of get another Handel from the time of something like L'Allegro and Penseroso forwards, that suddenly he, you know, reluctantly started writing in English or whatever, and then found that it was good. And that
I think he also, I mean, this is just conjecture on my part, but the idea of oratory as a a thing. Of course, you know, it goes back centuries, but the resurgence of the idea of oratory as being a means of expressing certain truths and certain ideas, albeit under the guise of an Old Testament story, a bit like we talked about in the operas as well, you know, that you can, I mean, you look at the libretto of something like Theodora, and you know, some of the stuff that's there is kind of really charged in terms of its political thought and just the way, you know, to send kind pity, heavenly guest, and fill each human breast with sympathizing woe. That, I mean, it's a kind of, again, a very, very direct way of speaking about stuff that perhaps you can, it's, if you like, it's a safe space. You know, we talk about this with opera the whole time, that people say, oh, I can't possibly see people being murdered on stage, or, you know, this is opera, whatever. And you go, no, this is exactly where you can see people murdered on stage, because it's actually the perfect environment, because we're actually not doing it. Mm-hmm. We're just
depicting, like rollerball.
We're just depicting it, and that's the point. And we, you know, if you need to discuss it or talk about it or be horrified or moved or whatever, that is what we do in theatre. We, you know.
And I mean, so the oratorios, in fact, I mean, dramatically as well as, and there's a dramatic difference between them as well, because they're sort of, you know, there's a sense in which the operas can be quite formulaic dramatically, you know, as the ruler goes crazy or goes off the rails or gets a girlfriend, and then that goes bad, and then he has to come back to his senses and be proper ruler again, you know, and do that, and then that society comes back to normal through that, and it's, you know, opera seria being a kind of primer for European princelings, which they paid great attention to, obviously. Whereas this is kind of, I mean, it's a sort of, this is the middle class entertainment, right? You worked with Peter Sellers on,
yeah, Theodora,
and he's very big on this.
Yeah,
I remember, you know, he's saying this is, things like Theodora are preparing people for democracy. He's getting in their heads and teaching them to think about these issues.
Well, the whole Thomas Paine thing, and he talks about that quite a lot when we did that piece. Yeah, I don't know. I mean, I think he was very drawn by a lot of the texts, a lot of the stories. Of course, they're much more linear in the storytelling than the operas in many ways. And apart from, interestingly, Solomon, although there's a whole other story about what that's actually about. I mean, I know Ruth Smith writes a lot, yes, about it, but also, I, interestingly, a very good friend of mine in New York was a great Handel fan, wrote a really interesting letter to me about the idea that was, yes, it was about trade and about displaying, you know, all of arts and all this kind of thing, but it's also about the, you know, the fight between, not the fight, but the tension between a more and more secular society dealing with God. And how is there a way in which we can both have God in our lives, but also have science and not have to say that, you know, God created every leaf and every tree, but we still can believe in God and believe that it's good. I mean, that for me was a super interesting idea of, and I looked at the text again in a very different light, thinking, you know, was that really the intention, or was it just by chance that came about in that way?
I wonder also whether Handel enjoyed the challenge of writing oratorio without drama, you know, because you've got to tell the story and you haven't got the prop, as it were, of acting and so on. So you've got to get all the dramatic interest into the actual music.
Although he does write stage directions, you know, and like, you know, in Theodora again, you know, enter Didymus, his visor closed. Now, quite obviously, he's not going to sing, and then he sings an aria, you know, and it's like, well, okay, but we need to know that she can't tell who he is. But of course, when they performed it, he didn't come on with a suit of armor and a visor closed. So there is a sense in which he's still seeing the drama as if it's, you know, it's staged.
Yeah, and so, but I mean, you're right. I mean, because those, the guys who were writing the libretto, so I can't remember who wrote Solomon, but Nubra Hamilton or something. So Hamilton and Jennens and Thomas Morell, I mean, they were all educated. They were all these kind of country gentlemen, and some of them were
Rickers.
Yeah, some of them were clergymen, exactly, and you know, and probably quite bored somewhere in Northamptonshire. And you know, with the country, with the local squire.
Well, Milton, and yeah, and Samson, of course, was a.
And they were, you know, they were kind of, some of them were these deists and this kind of thing. They were, you know, they were slightly unorthodox, as you could, you know, the Church of England being quite broad in those days. I think then with the birth of Methodism, there was a kind of evangelical revival, which was what kind of led to Handel's co-option by the state after his death. I think that, you know, that they suddenly became these rather kind of revivalist pieces of tub-thumping morality, which I don't think they were at the time. And suddenly Messiah kind of co-opted as the big English and trumpets and drums and, you know, God is an Englishman and all this kind of thing.
But that is the least typical of everything he ever wrote. I mean, even though it's the most famous piece, it's like nothing else.
But it is the legacy that, as you said at the beginning, has been most known for 100 years. It was all that, you know, and then it got bigger and better because they were so scalable, you know, the oratorios compared with the operas, you know, then all the Victorians and so on, you know, with their massive performances and so on.
I mean, they weren't wrong. You know, every time you hear it, you think, you know what? It's pretty good, isn't it?
Yeah. I mean, presumably it was unusually abstract for the time. I mean, think about the Bach Passions, they're proper narratives, aren't they, with commentary. And then Messiah's very sort of...
It's just like a scatter...
Yes, it's just colours, isn't it?
Yeah, and also, interestingly, it's the only, unlike the Passions, which do have Evangelist, Pilate, Peter, whatever, there's not a single named part in Messiah. He just writes soprano, alto, tenor, bass. Yeah. Which I think was definitely a choice, because he could have assigned it to people if he'd wanted biblical names or even made up names, but it's very clearly not about that.
Because it's interesting, because it's sort of the starting point, isn't it? I mean, certainly it was the first big Handel piece. We did bits of it at school,
right?
You know,
right.
And so it always determined my view of him. And actually, looking at it now, it's quite wild and wacky, isn't it?
Oh, completely. No, completely.
And unlike so many of the others. I mean, there's only that and Theodora that are Christian, and that comes onto the question.
So that has a proper story, doesn't it?
Yes. But, of course, that's partly for the audiences, isn't it? Because, as you say, the
I mean, it's
Jewish
kind of a literary experiment. That Jennings is, you know, he's doing getting the Isaiah prophecies and then seeing how they reflect in the New Testament, you know, kind of shoehorning them into the, which is, I mean, was not the first time anyone had done that, but it was... Yeah. It was a kind of popular form of biblical exegesis, this kind of thing.
But no one sort of questions. I don't know whether people do question it now, but I mean, presumably for two centuries, everyone just thought, this is Messiah, chung.
And this is the confusion. Well, you know, we did it at Christmas, but it's an Easter thing.
It's an Easter
thing. And because it actually covers all bases. This is the great thing about it. And it's I mean, obviously, it's, you know, very Christian.
Was it designed to be exerted, or was it always designed to be played as a whole? I mean, did he
wrote it a bit as a whole, and, you know, because it was for Lent when you couldn't do the opera, so you put on the oratorios instead. But I wonder if he didn't have named characters, because it was seen as such a sacred subject in a way, you know, that Jennings writes, you know, that, because, you know, of course, Jennings wasn't very happy with what Handel had written. And he's saying, I hope, you know, he'll set out his best effort because the subject excels all others. The subject is Messiah. And I wonder if at the time, because obviously they couldn't, you know, it wasn't acceptable to perform it in the theatre, which they did, but then there were letters to the papers saying it wasn't suitable because it was too sacred a subject. And I wonder if that's why he didn't want to name characters, because you didn't want a soprano to be Mary or whoever it was, you know, that it was, or someone.
And he probably couldn't actually represent them on stage. I mean, you know, putting biblical characters on stage was a bit iffy.
Yeah, although Old Testament seemed to be okay, but I think New Testament.
I always thought it was sort of a romantic idea that he wanted it all to be us declaring the story.
We are the chorus. Well, this is, I mean, the big thing about the oratorios, isn't it? Because the chorus is so huge. We were sort of, did you come to Saul the other day? They started off the Handel Festival with Jonathan Cohen and his gang, and it's incredible. There's this kind of huge celebratory cantata at the beginning, right, with all the trumpets and how excellent, and with a hallelujah chorus tacked onto it. And this is like, it's a huge choral thing with trumpets and trombones and kettle drums and special kettle drums from the Tower of London and everything. It's incredible. And then another one kind of at the end, and the chorus all the way through is commenting on everything. I mean, rather like the Greek chorus thing, which is clearly... Here, welcome back the people into
the sung drama, which they were excluded from right. in the operas.
Yeah, and also these huge orchestras. I mean, yeah. you know, you look at the operas and you can tell when he was, you know, promoting them himself because it's like basically strings.
So synthesizer.
Exactly, that's it. That's it. And then the oratorios, you know.
Handel on a Moog. I mean, he would have been great on his Moog. I think, you know, he would have been like Vangelis, kind of sitting there with the whole thing.
Harry, do you find a musical development or change in those, like from L'Allegro onwards? I've got, you know, L'Allegro, Messiah, Samson, Semele, Belshazzar, Hercules. You're just going on tour with yeah. Hercules now. Yeah. I mean, is there some kind of musical identifiable development or change in his, in the way that he does things? Because you can hear. I mean, partly it was about Swiss singers, right? He didn't have those Italian experts.
Right, right. Yeah, so he's not writing all these virtuosic coloratura aria. So they do exist in the oratorios, but it's not in the way that it was. You had to have it's like having a car chase in a movie. You know, you've got to have the car chase. You know, you have to have a fast coloratura aria. But I mean,
God, I'm going to think of that every time I hear one of them from now on. That's it.
But I think it's very healthy to think of things that way because yeah. it brings it back down to the original
yeah.
experience.
I mean, I would make a big distinction. I'm not the first person to say this between the Italian, you know, the stuff and the early Handel, which is just so out there. I mean, it's
Resurrezione.
Totally wild, impossible. I mean, you know, talk about stretching. I don't believe it. It's a bit like some of the Bach cantatas. You think, well, I can't believe anyone actually could sing that. But he's just writing it for, you know, a young man just saying, this is what I've written. And then you do see the practicalities of him actually dealing with people, dealing with not only people's technical deficiencies, but also their temperamental deficiencies and everything else, and writing stuff like that. And a sort of general refinement of scale as well, and that a lot of the stuff that, you know, he might not have worried about this, you know, he suddenly with commercial ear goes, I think that could be a bit long, you know, maybe we could just like tighten that up a bit. And then, as I said, we're talking about the manuscripts and just how he refined and refined musically to make things simpler and purer and just like the distillation of like, it's like making a fine perfume or something, you know, you need to pull that down. But lots of composers, you look at Mozart, you know, the difference between Traurigkeit in Entführung and Achifuss, which are basically sort of the same arias, but in Achifuss, you know, it's like, you know, 25 bars long and Traurigkeit goes on for about 15 minutes. And you just see someone, you know, going, actually, I can say this and I can do this, but just in a more powerful way.
Yeah, so there's something kind of more, I suppose the speech is kind of less flowery. There's less stuff about boats tossed on the sea and more about, you know, what's kind of actually going on.
I think there are very, very few simile arias when you get to the thinking about it.
Like as with Rosy Steps the Morn or something like that, but it's also very much, I mean, that is a kind of, and
well, know, it is, but it's not, it's actually Irene saying to the Christians, don't give up, you know, and so it is a simile aria, but it's actually also trying to tell, it does actually have a dramatic function.
And then not having to do da capos all the time.
Well, yeah,
and because every.
Although no, when you get to Xerxes, he quite clearly just stopped. You know, and there are very few da capo arias in Xerxes. It becomes more like, you know, a quick comedic narrative that needs to get on with.
I mean, Xerxes is just a fantastic opera. I heard you saying that you couldn't choose between Ariadante and Alcina. But I want to put Xerxes in there as well as one of the absolute.
Oh, if you throw that in the mix, it's even more impossible. Yeah, absolutely. Yeah.
But also there's this kind of sense of freedom. It doesn't matter anymore. The whole opera thing is over. I'm just going to, because it's that kind of semi-comedy that he always had fun with, like with Agrippina and Partenope.
Yeah.
And Xerxes is like, you know, Handel is possibly slightly leaden sense of humor. I don't know, but actually it's very light in the comedies.
Oh, and all the Elvira stuff is very funny, and actually I think Xerxes himself is, I mean, the whole situation thing, and again I remember that really revealing itself to me in that production at E&O where, you know, these characters playing themselves completely straight had us all in fits of laughter because they took themselves so seriously. And that is the comedy. It's not like trying to write a funny piece. It's just...
Also has an extraordinary... I mean, at the end, you know, he does the Radamisto thing of saying, okay.
Yeah. I'll stick with my official girlfriend.
Or go back to the official girlfriend, isn't it? Because she's dressed up as a chap and she's come from Persia or something. No, he's in Persia. She's come from somewhere else. But then there's this amazing reconciliation. It's a very long final
chorus.
Aria and chorus.
Exactly. Da, 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 yeah.
Da, da. And it's like a... It's you feel a kind of serious social reconciliation in it as well.
And it's interesting, as you say, that actually it's quite a long thing. I mean, he gives space to make that happen. Mm. Whereas often with these pieces, you know, you just... It's almost like a convention that you have a final...
Yeah, the perfunctory...
You do Hercules, and we've had... death by a thousand poison darts and then suicide and all this, and then they just sing this little triple time chorus. That's it, you know, go home now, you know. And it is quite hard to pull off because you think, well, what function does this actually have?
Is that because he didn't know what to do?
I don't know.
I don't know how to end. It's a well-known problem.
Interesting. Tamerlano's, I think, is the only opera that finishes with this dirge. Mm.
That's a really unusual... I mean, I don't know them all as well as Robert does, but that really is an unusual piece, isn't it? The last act is not like anything else.
Yeah, knows, yeah, yeah. The whole...
It's extraordinary. I mean, that's the one that strikes me as the...
Yeah, it is extraordinary, and it's actually a piece I find really hard to pull off, I have to say.
It can be quite grueling.
It's very, very long. It has the longest recit Handel ever wrote. It's famous. People get to it and go, oh, are we really doing all of this?
Is that the scene with when the attempted murders?
I
saw it. It works though, doesn't it?
It can work. Yeah,
when it works, it works. I'm one of the greatest things I've seen in it was the Pierre Audi production in Brussels. I think it started in Drottningholm. Right. And they're all in the incredible 18th century and completely empty stage. There's a chair on the stage and it's dark. One of those stages, yeah. You know? And nobody does anything apart from kind of sink to the floor under the weight of all this terror and horror. And it was brilliant. I couldn't breathe for 3 hours. And it's one of those. Yeah, sometimes it works. Yeah, sometimes absolutely. It happens. Harry, I just wanted to briefly talk about the opera Handel for All, because I noticed that I mean, for example, you've just released Rodelinda, which you recorded a couple of years ago. And now everyone's gone through it again.
No, I mean, I have to say, this is one of the problems, because we started this whole Handel Every Year project because of Carnegie Hall, because in 2008, when the big financial crash came, you know, like all organisations, Carnegie didn't really know what to do. I mean, because they were totally reliant on private funding. Yeah. And so, but they had to plan, and you can't not plan, but didn't whatever. And I happened to be talking to... Clive Gillinson, who's still running Carnegie Hall, and I kind of slightly facetiously said, "Well, you should do Handel operas because they, you know, they've not been done in London, in New York, super cheap, 5 cast, no chorus, small orchestra, fantastic music, you know, whatever." And anyway, he went away and then came back and said, "Actually, we'll just give it a go." In fact, the first one we did was Radamisto, and it was a huge success, and we've been going back every year ever since, and now it just sells out a year in advance. I mean, it's like this big thing. We do it 2 o'clock in the afternoon on a Sunday afternoon.
And it's still a kind of monopoly on Handel Opera.
You've
got both Boston and Lyric.
But it's been great.
Handel and Haydn and whatever it's called.
It's just a big event and people love coming to it. And so we did a lot of those there. And we used to also then tour them around to Vienna and various places, Madrid and the Concertgebouw. And then this whole idea of filming them all came up. So you're right, we are having now to do them all over again because they've not been filmed and they have to be filmed. They have to be filmed.
You'll be even better at them this time around, right?
Well, you know, I quite like the idea of you know, them being in our repertoire, actually. Mm. You know, that you have it like... In fact, Peter Jonas, you know, who used to run ENO and then went on to be intendant in Munich, was a huge Handel fan, and he was the one that got started with Xerxes, and then he did Julius Caesar with Charlie as well, and then Ariodante, of course, the David Alden Ariodante. And he always had this idea that when he retired, he was going to come back to London, and he wanted to have a sort of King's Theatre, and that we'd have, you know, an ensemble of singers and a resident pit band, and we would just do Handel operas like West End musicals. I didn't get involved in that.
I would love.
I thought.
I'll be a subscriber.
You know. Yeah, well, you come.
No, I'll be
you
there. Come. I'll be there.
You'll do a podcast about it.
And the other, well, I mean, one of the other things which you have got on the video is Risorizione,
yep.
With I think Lucy, isn't it?
Yes.
Doing Disarray. I mean, that the crazy start, which of course basically everybody needs to watch and contribute to. Because occasionally you have kind of cash calls, don't you, for this?
But I'm just looking up this because I asked Alfonso, who runs the Unicron, just to say, you know, it isn't a vanity project, to be honest. I mean, we're not charging anybody for it, and we, you know, it's actually a thing. But it just some of the figures that, you know, we get 6 million views across all the content. Over 27% of our audience is under 44. The latest clip of Dovizioso with Yestin has been seen 500,000 times and allowed us to reach 92% of people that did not follow us before. So, I mean, when you think about the way in which people now consume music, it's not CDs,
it's all streaming, absolutely.
It's streaming. And also having visual content is seemingly very important. Mm. And you know, as a small organisation, you know, we could never reach that number of people.
No, this is incredible. I mean, this is fantastic. And this is what, I mean, and the podcast will do its little, add as little to this. But this podcast, everyone has to go to come to the Foundling Museum, Catherine, to see the Catherine Cook collection and so forth. Gerald Cook. Did I say Catherine Cook? Gerald Cook. It's been renamed after you. This is it. This is it. I mean, Handel is, you know, he's the guy now, isn't he? He's absolutely the man, as this bespeaks very.
And also in London. I mean, yeah. if you go to Bonn, I mean, everything is about Beethoven. Right, yeah. You go to Salzburg, it's all about Mozart. You know, and yet.
And then neither of them can wait to get the hell out of Bonn and Salzburg.
Well, that may be true. But and people love to claim, you know, these people for their own Haller, obviously, as Handel too. But, you know, London, I mean, I will put a little plug in also for Handel Hendrix House, which I'm involved in. Yeah. You know, there's, you know, why do we not have the same kind of experience of Handel still being this huge figure in English musical life in London?
Partly because he's being reinvented by you before our very ears, Harry. So, like, when we have the reinvention of Handel, then there'll be some kind of massive shrine and centre for Handel. I think that's it. I think we're going to go and have lunch now, everybody. Fantastic. Thank you so much.
It was a pleasure.
Amazing.
Thank you.
If you enjoyed this podcast, then why not subscribe to have the magazine delivered directly to your door? Our current offer is just £25 for 5 issues and less than £45 for an entire year of Britain's best in-print publication. Subscribe now at www.thecritic.co.uk. Ha ha ha.